Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma samputassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma samputassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma samputassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. I don't know how many of you remember me, but I used to live here. So it's very good to be back. Very happy that Ajahn Tir Dhammo and the Sangha and committee are taking such good care of the monastery. The new building is exquisite. And when you put your heart into a place, you always hope that the good energy will continue. So sadhu, dharaja. It's very, very nice to be here. I left 10 years ago because my mother broke her pelvis. She was living in Ottawa. So I flew out to take care of her. And when I got there, she was already 87 when I got there, so pretty late in the piece. I had never really taken care of my mom. I left Toronto in 1969, so it was high time I cared for her. And so it was obvious that she couldn't live alone anymore, so I decided to help her out. And rather than put her into an old people's home, I wanted to actually care for her. So I moved into her condo. And a condo isn't the natural habitat of a forest monk. So that was an interesting adaptation. And it ended up being a bit longer than I expected. I was there for almost 9 years. But it was very, very rewarding, 9 years. Two best things I've done in my life is become a monk and take care of my mom. So I'm grateful for the time with her. She died in March at 96 years old. So now I'm able to get out of the Ottawa Valley and travel. So I've been to Hong Kong, Malaysia, Thailand. Now I'm here, I've been in Auckland, then I'll go to Australia, Laos, China, shave your head, see the world. So I'm kind of making up for lost time. It's good to be with Ajahn Tir Dhammo again. We were together in Thailand for some very inspiring meetings. It was Ajahn Chah's 23rd memorial of his passing away in Wapapong. And in that gathering there were 800 bhikkhus, 5,000 lay people, several hundred mechis. Now, it was very moving because I hadn't been together with this larger sangha for so many years. It was a very, very moving experience. I had tears of joy. And then previous to that meeting, we had a meeting of our senior Western monastics, and that was inspiring to see such dedicated practitioners and dedicated to the Dhamma, and old friends that I've known for a long, long time. So what can I talk about this evening? Perhaps I'll just talk about one of the difference between reflection and dogma. Reflection and belief, contemplation and belief. The Buddha's teaching is very beautifully laid out in an intellectual format. I find it very appealing intellectually. It's well thought out, it's well analyzed. But obviously if you leave the teaching as an intellectual structure, then it kind of becomes an artifact which everyone agrees upon. But it doesn't really liberate your heart. It's only when you take a teaching and you take some aspect of it and you internalize it, you make it alive within your own predicament, that teaching becomes meaningful in a sense of liberation. What do I mean by that? Well, let's say the teaching on impermanence. Everyone, you know, we always in Buddhism we talk about impermanence, and no one's going to disagree with you. Everyone will nod their head in agreement. But nodding your head in agreement is simply a kind of dogmatic position that we Buddhists take, or an intellectual agreement, but actually making alive this principle of change, or as Ajahn Chah would say, uncertainty, moment by moment is more difficult. So a gross example would be someone maybe sees the monastery and the website, young man, feels inspired, thinks, oh, I want to be a monk. I'll be a monk forever. Now that sense of inspiration arising in consciousness is uncertain. We all know that. We've all fallen in love and fallen out of love. But that you have to contemplate, you have to make that conscious. So the person feels inspired, and if they don't contemplate that as just a phenomenon in consciousness which arises according to causes and conditions and will change. If there isn't that kind of contemplative knowing, then when it morphs into disappointment, into whatever, then the mind doesn't see that, and the disappointment turns to aversion and criticism and judgment. And these guys don't know what they're doing. I'm out of here. I'm going to join Zen or take up golf or whatever. And that's this sense of reflection or contemplation is what I think we mean by wisdom. Wisdom is the capacity not just to hammer this out intellectually. That doesn't take that much work. You do have to use intellect. But reflection or contemplation or wisdom is this capacity to look at life and use the Dharma as a mirror. For instance, if I'm shaving, I cut my face to see where the cut is, to see where I have to put a Band-Aid. I look in the mirror. The mirror shows me, and I can position the Band-Aid onto my face. So the mirror shows me my face. And so the Dharma is a kind of mirroring, and reflection is that capacity to mirror, to be able to see our conscious experience in a much more objective way, rather than always being subject to various kinds of compulsions that bring us suffering and unhappiness. That's important. That's very important. Otherwise, we just go into Buddhist dogmatics, believing and so on. And then of course, you see that in religion, the position taking of religious institutions, or you see the position taking and even within Buddhism, different kind of argumentation. But the way I see the Buddhist teaching, he wasn't trying to describe an ultimate intellectual structure. He was giving us these really, really good tools. Really, really good tools that if we learn how to incorporate them into our worldview, if we learn how to recollect them, so mindfulness has this sense of recollection. You remember something. And what do you remember? That this is uncertain. Let's say you're talking about someone. We're always talking about each other, aren't we? No matter what they say about right speech, we're always going to be talking about each other. And you need to sometimes talk about other people. It's just, whatever. It's kind of necessary. So when someone tells you about someone, that this person is really fabulous or this person is really pathetic, when you receive that, when you hear that, you create a perception in your mind. You might believe or disbelieve, but there'll be some kind of response to that. You get the input, comes into consciousness, and you form a vision, either of the person speaking or of the person being talked about. And that's a perception that arises according to causes and conditions. Now, I think all of us have been, say, unskillfully influenced in that way. Maybe someone tells me something about someone and I totally believe it, and then I blast them because they've told me something. Third-party knowledge, I think we've all suffered from that. But the reflection on Dharma is that this perception that has arisen is uncertain. This story that someone tells me about another person, another place, is uncertain. It's not saying it's right or wrong. It's not saying that you shouldn't function that way. That's just the way perception works. But just just the very fact to say this is uncertain. What does that do for the mind? What does that do? Well, for me, what it does, it brings awareness up. You know, I'm conscious that this is a perception. Whereas if that doesn't take place, that this is just a perception, then what happens is there tends to be a belief and a kind of solid reality, a me and a them, and so on and so forth. And that is the cause of suffering. Perceptions you have of yourself. Let's say I was talking to a very good friend who was saying that he just does not believe in his personality anymore. Think about that. What is your personality? Well, part of your personality is like self-judgment. Let's say let's say part of your personality makeup is quite self-critical, other critical, self-critical. And then you do something which is it's not up to top standard. You drop something or you say something and you walk away from it. And your personality says, oh, you fool, or you silly person, or you shouldn't have done this and you shouldn't have done that. That's a thought. That's a perception that has arisen, causes and conditions. Now, when I say uncertain or changing, as soon as I say that, I become objective. I know this is simply a movement of consciousness. This is not a fixed reality. If I can't bring up awareness of Dharma, then I am that fool. I am that self-disparaging person and I suffer. You walk into a room maybe and you feel judgmental about someone or critical about someone. This person is too loud or this person is too whatever, that's a perception that has arisen in consciousness. It arises because of causes and conditions. Might be true, but grasping it in with a self-sense, the ego sense, is a cause of suffering. But seeing, oh, this perception is uncertain, you're taken back to mindfulness, awareness. And so in this teaching, this capacity for reflection or contemplation, when you hear the word reflection or contemplation, it does sound like thought. But if you take Buddhism and you just think about it, you just go into more doubt. You cannot figure out Buddhism through thought. You can use thought to make conscious the way things are, but insight comes from silent attention rather than endless analysis. It's a whole different quality. So to go beyond thinking and yet to use thinking, to go beyond thought and yet use thought as an entry into the silence of knowing Dharma. This is what we mean by knowing Dharma rather than attachment or clinging. The self-perceptions, like this person that was saying that the conditioned nature of their self-perceptions is quite negative for various reasons or whatever. And that's the way self-definition comes up for him. And he says, I don't trust my personality. An interesting way to put it. Quite often, in our modern Western culture, we're trying to make our personalities perfect. That's not Buddhism. Buddhism is practice right speech, practice generosity, practice morality, but don't worry about your personality. It's just a conditioned phenomenon. You are not your personality. You aren't. Your personality, if someone praises you, someone praises me, they tell me you're great, fantastic talk, you're wonderful. What does personality do? It says, I like that person. Yeah, they've got a lot of insight. Person comes, says I'm a complete, I don't understand a bloody thing you're talking about, I don't know what you're talking about. I say, that person's got a lot of work to do. Personality comes up like that, right? But it's just conditioned phenomena arising and ceasing. So in personality and conditioned phenomena, you won't find freedom. In thought, you won't put an end to doubt. Where does doubt end? Like if the nature of your consciousness is always to try to figure things out, what do you do with doubt? You keep thinking. But where does doubt cease? When you stop thinking. You have a doubt. Well, what is this about? What should I be doing? That's just a thought. And when you bring up Dharma, you say, this is changing. This is a movement dependent on causes and conditions. Then what happens is, you know, a thought arises, stays for a while and ceases. That's the end of doubt. You'll always have doubts, but what's the end of doubt? You'll always not know things. You can't know everything, but what's the end of doubt? Existentially, it's the silence of the mind, the stillness of knowing, thought as thought. It arises and ceases. Coming to the end of thought is difficult. If we observe our consciousness, how much of time is spent in thinking? And if you just like, well, all of us observe that, the mind is usually tripping off pretty busy. And how much of that thought is actually right thought, and how much of it is just habit? It's blah, 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 right? We all have it. So to actually notice thought as an object that arises and ceases, you have to see it as Dharma. And you can see how if my whole sense of Buddhist practice is just thinking about Buddhism all the time, reading, analyzing, thinking, this, you cannot put an end to thought by thinking. You can only put an end to thought by knowing thought is thought. And you can only think rightly when you know that relationship. Yeah? So seeing thought as something that arises and ceases as an object, rather than being the subject all the time of this thinking, is an important part of Buddhist awareness, Buddhist awakening. When we talk about Buddhist practice, we talk in ways of our social responsibility, and we talk about the ways of stream of consciousness. So when we talk about social responsibility, we talk about who I am. I am a bhikkhu. My name is Ajahn Viradhammo. I have responsibilities. My body is 65 years old. I have an itinerary. I have to make sure to cancel something on Wednesday, right? There's a sense of a social being. And within that, what we might call social dharma, what the Buddha emphasized was generosity, morality, responsibility. And that's how we order our social life. We try to do as much good as possible and as little harm as possible. When we talk about generosity, we talk not just about sharing my resources, but we also talk about self-sacrifice. The self-sacrifice a parent has for a child, or a child for a parent. It's a very important part of taking the practice deeply away from the sense of egotism, away from the sense of self. So that, and morality too. Morality is a kind of commitment we have to do as little harm as possible. And then parallel to that, at the same time, in tandem to that, all the time, there is this reflection on stream of consciousness. So both are happening. There's both a sense of me living in time, having my responsibilities, doing my duties, but also the observation of the sense of self coming and going, the observation of thought coming and going, the observation of emotion arising and ceasing, the observation of memory coming and going, the observation of memory triggering passion or whatever coming and going. And in that sense of witnessing Dharma, knowing Dharma, this is what we mean by refuge, Buddha knowing Dharma. If I come into a situation and I feel quite critical of it, if I can awaken, now this is the critical mind feels this way, I can still pay attention to that criticism. I'm not saying I shouldn't be critical, but when I know it, oh, criticism feels this way, then that's Buddha. Buddha is that awake mind, and Dharma is that this is a condition, a phenomena. When there isn't Buddha knowing Dharma, then I tend to take refuge in the criticism. I own the criticism. I become the criticism. I'm just a critical person, criticizing all the time. Right? And that's not a very unhappy way to live. If I take some kind of Buddhist goody-good attitude, oh, I shouldn't be critical, that's another sense of self. Right? So let's say you read these teachings on having compassion for all sentient beings. And then you start to hate your neighbor because the dog is pooed on your grass or something like that, right? And then you see this anger come up. And you think, oh, may he be happy, maybe he happy. I love his dog, but you don't. You hate his dog and you wish he would move away. And obviously, if you're not honest to that, you're not really awake. You're just doing Buddhist dogmatics. Good Buddhists are always kind, and you become a kind of a doormat. Vice versa, if you just take the critical mind and then, you know, litigate and try to sue and get rid of this guy, you're caught in that. And what's the middle way? Well, the middle way is being socially responsible and maybe speaking to the man and so on, or building the fence or whatever you have to do. But also the middle way is to know, aversion feels this way. Aversion arises because of a cause. Aversion is uncertain, it changes. And that's Dharma, that's an awakening and knowing, oh, this is aversion. Attachment is, that idiot, you know, I'm going to shoot his dog, or I shouldn't feel this way, I should love them all the time. That's all self-view. But as soon as you see that self-perception arise, I shouldn't feel angry, the knowing of that perception, that's Dharma. It's not being perfect, being some kind of a saint, and then feeling guilty that you can't reach that ideal, right? The reflection, you see what I mean? The contemplative mind rather than the believing mind or the disbelieving mind. You see, it's things like how do you work with past lives? You know, how do you handle that one? In Asia, it's just believed. In Thailand, say, it's a culture where rebirth is just commonplace. Knowledge, information, cultural knowing. So what do you do with that? Like a Western meditator, Sangha, just dismiss that. Well, you can dismiss it. That's one way to do it. But then you're kind of throwing out quite a lot of the Buddha's teaching and morphing it into some kind of Western critique of another philosophy, which Westerners have been doing for a long, long time. They do that to every Aboriginal culture, right? So, but what if you have this teaching on rebirth? You can't prove it. I'm not a psychic. I've never seen a rebirth experience, so I don't really know. But I can use that kind of contemplative, reflective mind and say, well, okay, what if rebirth were true? So I'm not dismissing it. I say, okay, what if that were true? What would that mean about my life? Huh? What would that mean about my experiences of life? What if I just try it on as a working hypothesis? What would that mean? Well, it would certainly change your worldview. Certainly change your worldview. How you don't know? You don't know. It's the kind of thing where you experiment with the mind, say, okay, let's say there is rebirth. Let's say that the difficulty I'm in right now with this person is deeper than just this particular psychological moment. It's something more profound. I don't know what it is, but what if it's more profound? Maybe there's more acceptance. Maybe there's a different attitude. So you can use reflective mind that way. And that's a problem sometimes in some, one of the problems, I think, in Ajahn Tu and I have talked about this, that say Western Buddhism, sometimes the things that aren't can't be proved by contemporary science, or that some person hasn't seen, gets dismissed. And well, that's, you know, that can't be. And gets kind of, I think, dumbed down to a kind of level that just remains maybe just kind of psychological, socio-psychological. But there are beings who have profound insight. And I think I need the humility to say, well, I think there are beings who have seen more than I have. There could be more profound truths than I've particularly seen. And so faith in the Buddha, going back to the ideas of attachment to belief, faith in the Buddha is not so much just blindly believing, because that won't free you, but actually picking up aspects of the teaching and say, what's he pointing to there? Why is he pointing to that? Why is that important? How do I reflect on that? And that's different than believing or disbelieving. It's the faith to take something on board seriously and consider, well, if that's true, what does that mean in my life? So it starts to kind of work very deeply within you. That's faith, I think. Not as just blind belief, but as the willingness to to trust the teacher, to trust that the teacher had some profound transcendent realization, and that he had a profound way of offering that to us. That's looking at Buddha as teacher, you know, as a being who had the compassion to share the insight for many, many years, and then how that was taken through the ages through different teachers, and we receive that today. So that's Buddha as teacher. But then you take that teaching on board, you study it, we all study it, it's very important to study it, but then you don't just leave the study as an academic paper. It's not like Buddha, you know, Buddhist one, you could write a paper, couldn't you? Buddhism 101, you get an A. And then, you know, go home and kick the cat. Or suffer in some way. So where does intellectual insight, how does it morph, or how does it go into gut-felt insight, liberating insight? I think that's the challenge of the teaching. If you take like precepts, one of the challenges I've had, I live near the borders of Quebec in Canada, and there's Catholicism is very strong in that part of the world, used to be less so now, but a lot of the people that come to the monastery have a Catholic background. And when they interpret Buddhism, they interpret it from a Catholic bias oftentimes, not deliberately, just circumstantially, that is their perception of religion. And so when we talk about precepts, they will often think in terms of good and evil, sort of very absolute terms, good and evil. And so they actually have a hard time with precepts, but they're actually very moral people. So the hard time with precepts is this kind of idea that it's absolute, it's good and evil. But a reflective mind, you know, a reflective mind takes the precepts as mirrors. So if you take the precept on right speech, I undertake the training, the precept, the training to not lie, to not speak, not swear, to not speak divisively, to not speak stupidly. I undertake the training to speak in ways which bring concord, to speak truthfully, you know, to speak according to Dhamma. Now that is as a position, as an ego position, you could feel really guilty within 4 hours. Oh God, I can't do this. I'm a terrible person. You know, I distorted the truth yet to make myself look good, or oh, I said bloody in the talk, and that would be like a position, wouldn't it? I am someone who must keep the precept, and that's a kind of good and evil mindset. It's all or nothing. But as a mirror, pick up that precept in the morning, read it over, make a commitment to it, then what happens? You find yourself talking and there's maybe 5 people around the water cooler, and you start rip someone down. Someone starts to rip someone down. And now, because you've taken the precept, you have a mirror which shows you, don't rip them down, that's wrong speech. That leads to discord, that leads to hurt. And so the mirror helps you see this arising of wanting to get off on gossip. You know, what did you oh yeah, it's the excitement over the interest in gossip. We all have it as human beings. That's why the tabloids, you know, they love to gossip about rich people. And so you know, the mirror of right speech shows you something arising now which you need to look at. You see, and maybe you see the arising of a mindset which wants someone else to look bad so you can look good. That's ego, isn't it? That's not skillful. But as it arises, because you've taken this reflective teaching, you've taken that precept seriously, you can see it arising. And as it arises, you can make a choice. You can make a choice. I think I'll refrain on this one. That's mindfulness. And that's a choice coming from mindfulness. And having made that choice, maybe you'll see then that the result is very good. That the result is I'm not afraid that person will find out what I was talking about. Or I don't feel remorse, or I don't feel they're talking about me, I feel less fear, or whatever. So then, through that kind of contemplative, mindful process, you say, hey, right speech pays off, it's good. And you get better at right speech. Now that's contemplation, practice, training, wisdom rather than I should just be a perfect person and never say anything in any way, whatever. Negative, huh? Reflection, contemplation. I have a friend who keeps the precepts very assiduously, and he was in a situation where, just to share this with you, he had an infestation of mice in his house. And just live traps and all of that. And so one day he closed up all the mouse holes somehow, and this mouse now was on his floor. And it's now man versus mouse, right? So he finally got it, caught the mouse in a bag or something. It was the middle of the night, he's in his pajamas. So he then jumps in his car and goes to a park somewhere, lets the mouse go. When he comes back, and there's a police cordon around his neighborhood, and so there's a police, and someone had robbed a house. So picture him now. He's in his pajamas. And the policeman, and he says, "And what are you doing?" "Oh, I just let go of a mouse." But he kept the precepts. So sometimes we have to go to great measures. But sometimes, like with precepts, it's just something happens where you have an infestation of something or other and it's dangerous and you have to do something about it. You take responsibility. But always just having that kind of mindfulness and reflective capacity which sees where intention is coming from, which notices cause and effect. This is a beautiful thing, isn't it, as a human being? So on a just living life, mindfulness is very, very important. But also, what's very important about mindfulness is we also say mindfulness is the gateway to the deathless. And it's important to remember that the Buddhist teaching is not simply a teaching, a good social philosophy and a good psychology, that the Buddha had a deep realization, had a transcendent realization, had an understanding which he sometimes, in the way he talked about this understanding, says there is the unconditioned, the uncreated, the deathless. There is Nibbana. There is an end to suffering. There is the haven. There is the island. There is the refuge. There is peace. And so this was not just a kind of readjustment of his psyche to be a kind of nicer guy or a nicer person. He was a very accomplished being, but it was something very, very profound. And so then he taught from that realization. This is why he taught. He taught from that. And then he taught about non-grasping, non-clinging, about awareness of change. Now when you have more and more intuition and confidence in that capacity to be aware of change, you begin to see that awareness itself is not conditioned in the same way. It's not good or bad. It's not big or small. It's not feminine or masculine. It's not Kiwi, Canadian, or Polish. It knows. And the problem we human beings have in terms of transcendence or the liberating kind of teachings or liberating kind of possibility as human beings is we tend to get caught up in objects. Thought. How much time do we spend in thought or emotional or analysis or gadgets or off into the past and future. And the capacity just to know this moment as it is, as a changing phenomena, all objects point to awareness. All objects point to awareness. And we don't notice the awareness, we notice the objects, we're caught by the objects. And that's why we talk about craving. Craving is always this attempt to, as they say, organize the deck chairs on the Titanic. And it's always trying to get it right on the external, get your thoughts right, get your personality right, get your body right, get your computer programs right or whatever. And that, we do that, but that's not the transcendent teaching, that's the world teaching. Transcendent teaching is that mindfulness is the path to the deathless. And mindfulness is not control. When I awaken to some kind of negative impulse, I'm not, it's not a demand that, that all impulses are positive. It's just, no, this impulse is negative. Morally, I don't act on it. But as a contemplative, it's just stuff. It's just stuff coming and going, arising and ceasing. And having trust in that is very important. You're really trusting that awareness is the liberating possibility. So then, from that, as trust deepens, then you begin to be able to do what we call purification. And all of us have, you know, all of us have kind of patterns which are deeply ingrained in our psyche. And these patterns are very often governed by fear or aversion or whatever. So my big thing this lifetime has been fear, a lot of fear, kind of fear which just didn't make any sense in terms of my upbringing and so on. And there's been a lot of churning over of fear in consciousness. But that fear is not suffering. The fear is unpleasant, but it only becomes suffering with clinging. When there is no longer the objective seeing of fear, then the grasping of fear, I become a fearful person. All of us, I think, know the difference between being angry and knowing anger, right? There's a difference, isn't there? You can start to feel uptight in a Wellington traffic jam. You probably don't have that or something. Okay, the road maybe is closed and you feel uptight because you have a dental appointment. And you're caught, and then, this is a feeling of being uptight. There's a difference between anger, being angry and knowing anger, right? And when you know anger, when you know fear, and you know, oh, this is just a condition, it's uncertain, it's changing, then as it arises, it affects your body, it affects the imagery, it affects your interpretation of life, but you know it, this is changing, then it might be very uncomfortable. It might be very, very uncomfortable, but as it goes through you, you begin to no longer identify it, and there's a kind of purification. And so the fear and the anger and the aversion and lust and all that, they go through consciousness, but they're no longer fed. They're no longer believed in. They're no longer given nutriment. And because they're not fed with self-thought, as they begin to cease, your heart begins to be released from those tendencies. It no longer has the tendency to go that direction of suffering. And the heart, we call that the release of the heart from these difficult tendencies. Now, that kind of peace of release is different than the peace of comfort. When we feel comfortable, then we have everything we want. When we feel uncomfortable, especially emotionally, when things begin to rub us up the wrong way and we feel these things, now that is a more interesting place to practice. It's easy to be in a place of comfort, right? But discomfort, emotional discomfort, as it comes up, if you remember that now I have a chance to develop a capacity to be aware of even this fear or this aversion or whatever, even that, and your consciousness becomes bigger. It's bigger than the particular phenomena which is now manifesting. It's bigger than that. And that kind of bigness, the idea of space, a non-attachment, non-grasping, consciousness, knowing, change, you begin to sense the freedom of that. But it takes a lot of confidence and trust and awareness, it takes a lot of courage, it takes a hell of a lot of patience. It takes a lot of patience. Sometimes the manifestations of fear and desire in different ways can be very, very disturbed, very, very powerful, depending on our conditioning. But what else would work? So sometimes we think a compensation would work. So I feel lonely, have some yogurt. Lonely, play some music. Lonely. And then you find, all these compensations aren't working. So then one day you say, loneliness feels this way, uncertain, changing. And you have that perspective of Buddha knowing Dharma. Now the loneliness doesn't feel great, but now you know, loneliness feels this way, it goes through you. Goes through you, it's uncomfortable. And this is where the desire comes up. The desire comes up for comfort, compensation. I don't want this loneliness, it'll be here forever. No, this will change. Trust and awareness. So then, that takes courage. And it's almost counterintuitive. It almost feels like, I should do something about this, fix it. Well, usually the only way we know how to fix it is some kind of compensation. So now we've done that for 10 years maybe. And now we're willing to really embrace it and witness it. And that's where you have to go to no thought. You don't have to analyze it, figure it out, get rid of it, understand it, but just be. Just be. Just know. This feels terrible. It feels this way. And as I was saying to someone earlier today, Ajahn Sumedho will call this an emotional anima. Good image, huh? Emotional anima. Comes through you, and if you can witness to it with no thought, just feels this way. How can you do that? You go to the body. You feel it as a pressure, as a vibration, as a tension, as a tightness, as a heat, whatever it might be, and you bear witness in that way. This will change. No, it won't. Yes, it will. Right? I have to do it. No. And you just, because you trust more and more in awareness, then as it goes through you, it begins to cease, and the desire to do something about it begins to cease. Mindfulness is more powerful, so you've developed mindfulness, stronger mindfulness, and these things begin to cease, and then the heart begins to have a sense of release. And then that kind of peace, that kind of happiness is unassailable. You know, because it's something that is just natural. It's a natural consequence of that kind of practice. The peace of comfort and compensations is very transitory. It's very dependent on cause and conditions. 2 spoons of the yogurt, and then you're off, you know, switch the television on or whatever it might be. So as human beings, we have, in a Buddhist sense, we have a responsibility as social beings to do the maximum amount of good, minimum amount of harm in this planet. We have that kind of responsibility, and we have a responsibility to understand consciousness, to understand our mind, and to realize the deathless. This is why the Buddha taught, and this is why really we're here to realize. All right? I'll leave that for your reflection.